The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? It is Thursday, and a massive thank you to you all for such a phenomenal response to John Sims' episode last week. Even though we're mates and we work together, it's very rare that we get to sit down and turn the spotlight and the focus onto one person for around an hour each week, and that's what we do week in, week out. And this week is no exception, because last week I got a knock on my door and E. McKenney came round for a cup of tea and a chat. It was fun. I invited her. She didn't just find out where I lived and come on over. It was arranged. And we'd never met before. And I think we got on like a house on fire. It was such a laugh. She's really good company. I really think you're going to enjoy this. Can I say really anymore? Yes, I really, really can. It's currently a half term where I am, and we're just taking a break from learning how to draw manga characters, and it stopped raining, which is good, so now we can go out this afternoon. But if it's raining where you are, then you need to curl up, and after this I want you to go on all four, Channel 4 in the UK, and watch a new series called The Curse, which stars our guest today, E. McKenney, and past guest Tom Davis. And Tom and James DeFrond teamed up with the People Just Do Nothing boys and created this show, and it's very funny. It's really good. Tom, as you know from Murder and Successful, just a brilliant comedian. If you haven't heard his episode, do go back through the seasons and find it. I think Tom's in the first season. And also the link there is also jump on that, jump on to Laura Checkley, who co-stars him with him in King Gary. And watch The Curse. It is brilliant. We do talk a bit about it. There's no spoilers or anything in this episode with Ema. But we start off by talking about how I approached Ema. And unbeknownst to me, her husband, the broadcaster, Rick Edwards, who will be coming on the podcast in the next couple of weeks. And this is how it started. Enjoy, and I'll see you at the end.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Do you know how nice it is to have somebody sort of ring the bell
of my house and then come round and record a podcast. But it's been so long.
Yeah.
Because I've been doing everything over
via
the bloody...
Zoom or phone.
I'm sick of it.
Yeah, I know.
It's so horrible.
I know.
But here's the funny thing. So obviously over the years we've been broadening the conversations mm-hmm. with different people, you know, not just actors, all sorts of people. And I love broadcasting. I love radio. Mm. And I love, you know, people who conduct great interviews because they really listen. Great people on radio really listen.
Yeah.
And I think you can tell when people aren't listening or they're kind of faking it.
Yeah.
And I follow Rick Edwards on Twitter and he follows me. So I thought, yeah, I really like Rick. And I think that's really interesting about where he's come from to where he is now.
Yeah.
So I was messaging him saying, oh, look, I know you've just moved to Manchester because one of my friends was talking about him. I said, oh, well, yeah. So I messaged him and said, would you like to come on the podcast? And he said, yeah, that's great. And let's sort that out. And then when I saw The Curse the other week with my friend Big Tom and I saw you, I thought, yeah, she'd be great. So I messaged you.
Yeah.
Wholly independent. I said to my producer, I've booked this guest, I've got this guest coming up. And he went, oh, yeah, those two would be good. You know they're married. I went, no, I didn't know.
You're married.
I know, but I hadn't done any research at that point, so I wasn't aware at all. So do please explain to Rick that I was doing that independently.
He won't mind.
Did he know? Did he know you were coming to do this?
Yeah. I told him. And he was like, he asked me now too. I was like, well, fine. I thought I was special, but no. Yeah, no.
No, you are, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
It's funny how these things come about.
Yeah.
So let's talk about London. Let's talk about moving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is this going to be a permanent thing?
Well, we're trying to work it out. So Rick, to explain to listeners, Rick is my husband and he's a...
This is Rick Edwards, by the
way. Rick Edwards. He's a presenter and he got offered a job at Five Live to do The Breakfast Show, which is a really big deal.
Yeah.
It's a big show and Nicky Campbell did it for 22 years. So it's quite a big change for the channel and he was really happy to be asked. But we've lived in London and for my whole life, for most of his life, and the show's based in Salford.
Mm.
But he said, I'm going to say no. And I just said, I don't think you can. I don't think you can. I think it's an amazing opportunity. And he's really good at radio. He kind of has an amazingly broad knowledge about things. So he can kind of go from sport to politics to whatever. So I said, just take it and we'll work it out afterwards. So now we're sort of halfway between both because I keep getting work down in London and he's been up here. So we're looking for a place up here and I'm trying to get my head around Manchester, which is, I mean, everyone says it's a great city.
It's a great city.
Yeah.
And also, you can walk a lot of places.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere. And even in a car, you go, well, it's 10 minutes that way, it's 10 minutes the other way.
Yeah.
And you're not far from the countryside.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Though I know you gave one of your answers in the Patreon special. If you want to hear all that, you better sign up for Patreon. Very, very exciting. But it is a great city and it's a friendly city.
Yeah. And it's got a lot going on. I wrote a list of restaurants to try and there were 67 on that list. I was like, oh, okay, this is like, there's a lot of great restaurants, shops, stuff going on.
E. McKenna, you've come to the right place. I'm the right person to talk to about food and restaurants.
And you live near all of them.
I live near quite a few.
Yeah.
My friend Lindsay, who's originally from Manchester, but she lives in London now, was coming up for the half term. So I met her last night without the children. But it was really hard trying to book into a restaurant on a Tuesday night. Everywhere was booked up.
Yeah.
And then we found one place that was really good. And we just sort of had to wait a little bit. And by the time we got there, and this was at 8 o'clock, they went, really sorry, we've only got three things left on the menu. We're going to run out of food.
Oh my God, it's like a
by this point,
foodie
hot spot. Starving.
Yeah.
But it is great for restaurants, I must admit.
Yeah. I mean, London's crazy to get into restaurants. You can't, but you have to book it like weeks in advance now. So I was hoping Manchester was going to be better, but no. Apparently.
No, I don't think so. I think it's slowly becoming like New York. You can't just sort of trot up and, I mean, there's certain places that don't take bookings and you just got to roll the dice.
Hope and pray.
Well, yeah. But you'll be fine. There's a wealth of riches in Manchester.
Yeah.
But I know that you tweeted the other day about, and it was very funny because, and you're kind of right as well, two Londoners kind of moving up, it means you've got to have conversations with people.
Yeah, everyone says hello to you.
Yeah, they do.
People want to chat in cafes.
People have a chat in the shops when you're at the till.
I feel so unnerved because they're not used to it. I'm like, what do you want from me?
You see, it's hard for a Northerner who spent a lot of time in London because I used to live I've lived in London from, I moved when I was 18.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm 45 now and then got out. But when we lived in Camden and we were in flats, I didn't know
who was
people at
the
top and I didn't know the people at the bottom. Yeah. It just didn't happen. And now since I've moved back north, it's like I know loads of people on my street now.
Yeah.
We just stop and have a natter and see how everybody is.
Yeah. I think Rick, because he talks to people for his job, he is so allergic to talking to people for the rest of the day because he's just like, doesn't want to talk to anyone. And also, you know, he was on TV. I can't spend the whole time talking about him because, you know,
Rick Edwards love his own bloody podcast, all right?
I hope he spends half of it talking about me.
He bloody better do.
But because he, you know, started out in youth, like doing T4 and all that, he'd get quite a lot of, like, louty shouting at him in a lovely way, but that's what he's used to, is the sort of usual chat. So I think he's quite blinkers on when he's out and about in the world. So yeah, it's probably worse outside of London. So that's a whole new experience, but we'll get used to it.
Of course we'll get used to it. But let's talk about London. Should we talk about growing up?
Yeah, sure.
Because it's Haringey is quite vast.
Yeah.
So we need to sort of pinpoint whereabouts.
So I grew up in North London, around sort of like my family my grandpa came over from Ireland with four of his brothers.
Whereabouts in Ireland?
The West, Roscommon.
Oh, right, okay.
And they had a building company in North London, this sort of like big Irish building community. And my dad took it over and now my brother's taking it over. And so I grew up in Highgate up and yeah, that was the kind of family community that I grew up in.
You didn't fancy joining the family business?
No.
You didn't even think about it, did you?
Not really. No. But I do love buildings and houses and property, and I think that comes from that. I'm kind of fascinated by it all. But didn't want to actually go into the building industry.
You go more to the creative side.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it big family?
Yeah, I'm one of four.
Right.
And then my grandpa was one of eight and the other one was one of nine. And so that kind of, my dad was one of three, my mum was one of four. So like there's a lot of cousins and uncles and aunties floating around.
So when there's a family get together, it's a big
deal. Yeah.
Your wedding must have been huge.
It was actually. I had 50 family actually, which was actually quite low, and like 10 friends at the ceremony, and Rick had like 10 family and 50 friends. And that's just because of our backgrounds being slightly different.
How was school, Emma?
School was I hated school actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I went to a girls' school that was really competitive and really intense, and I was quite creative, and it was quite an academic school. And
was there no outlet for your creativity?
I basically used to do tons of youth theatre, and I got an agent when I was 16.
Did you?
Yeah, and I kind of did lots of that when I was a teenager, and that was, I just didn't really turn up for school very much.
Go where you wanted, I'm with you on this, yeah.
My friends hated it, because I was sort of, I was quite patchy in turning up, and my teachers hated it. My parents were unbelievably laissez-faire. They kind of didn't really mind as long as I was happy, and I was quite happy. So I'd be going off to auditions and, yeah.
So you knew what you wanted to pursue at quite an early age?
I think so, yeah. It was definitely always going to be creative, and acting, it felt, yeah, I think from, yeah, I did know. I'm trying to pretend like there was a journey. I did know.
No, I think it's so, I mean, it's not that common to know what you want to do at 14, 15 or 16 so early on.
Yeah.
Like my son is turning 11 this year and he always has a top three of things that he wants to do, and they keep shifting. But I know some people in their late 30s and early 40s who go, yeah, I mean, I haven't found it. Haven't found it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I consider, you know, people in our profession, like, really lucky.
Yeah.
Even though other people who do quote unquote, you know, normal jobs or a 9 to 5 Monday to Friday,
yeah.
a structured
yeah.
job, would look at what we do and go,
oh my God, I know.
How could you?
I know.
How could you possibly throw yourself out and just be at the hands of somebody who's going to open the door or close it to you?
I know. And the lifestyle, like when someone says, can you be at my wedding on this day? And you're like, yeah, yeah, in theory I can be there. And then, but you have no idea what you're going to be doing. That's the bit that other people can't really... It seems rude to other people that you can't commit.
Yeah, I've just had that before. I had someone going, can you give me an answer to this? And I went, I don't know because it's on the 18th of March and I can't...
I don't know.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
But sometimes you just have to go, you might as well just fill the space with somebody who can definitely make...
Yeah, if you need me to definitely be there, like, I can't tell you until, I mean, literally the day before, maybe.
But I think it is really healthy and vital to block time off and go, no, I'm going away.
Yeah.
I'm taking that time off. I'm taking that week or 10 days off.
Yeah.
And we're going on holiday. And no, I don't want to, like, I've got half term next week and I've got my little boy with me all week. And I've said, I can't read anything. I can't do anything.
Yeah.
So just block it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's great. And I found myself, I think I'm a bit workaholic-y, and I found myself getting really depressed in August and December every year. And I realised it was because work really slows down because, like, everyone leaves the office and goes on their holidays, so you don't get the same amount of auditions or, like, writing meetings or whatever. And I just realised I need to do something then. I need to block it off and go, no, I'm not going to wait around just waiting for the phone. I need to go and do whatever and actually take time for life because otherwise I'll just be sitting around sad. And that's... I'm not going to miss anything that big, you know. It's better to be...
But it's good for your mind and your heart to be doing something, even if it is a world away from your job.
Yeah.
To be getting up and doing something instead of waiting around for a fucking email or something exactly. and go, oh... Inevitably, you're going to be disappointed when the script comes because you go, oh, they want me to do that again today. Oh, great, brilliant.
Exactly.
We'll get on to acting in a bit, obviously, because there's loads I want to unpack. But I really want to talk about writing.
Definitely.
When did that start?
So...
And also, why did it start?
So I think now, there's loads of reasons why, I think. I think I would have ended up doing it eventually.
Right.
But there are a couple of catalysts. I was acting since I was a teenager and I loved it, but I found, as many actors do, a lot of it really frustrating, the lifestyle part of it, that I didn't have any control over what parts I was going to go up for, what parts I was going to be seen for, what I was getting.
Did you find that frustrating even in the teens and late teens?
So much.
Right.
Because at that particular time, it was like 2007 to 2010 or something, I was a teenage girl, and it's so weird to think now, but so many of the parts were sort of semi-naked. Yeah. And I just, none of the actors that I knew, the guys, were having to do as much of that. And every actress I know who was kind of like, was having to do a sex scene or something. I mean, the first job I did had a really, I was 16, 17, had a really big sex scene in it and a topless scene. And so I was in at the deep end straight away.
Wow. And I bet back then, I mean, you're only early 30s now, aren't you? So it's not that long ago.
It's not that long ago.
But I bet there wasn't in place, as there is now, like an intimacy coordinator, was there?
No, not at all.
They've only just come in.
Yeah. And I don't mind doing that stuff, actually. I mean, I mind it less now because I'm just older and wiser and know what I'm doing. But at that point, I was terrified and I felt like I had to do it or I wasn't getting the job.
That's not a nice position to be in.
No.
At such a young age.
Yeah. But I actually, just to go into this quickly, I had the most amazing first AD on the first job I did, who I had this big sex scene and I barely had sex in real life at that point, but that sort of teenage fumbling.
Yeah.
And it was this like 35-year-old sort of supporting artist guy. And I had to get on top of him on a chair in a tattoo parlor and like basically just sort of ride him. And there was an amazing first AD called Lydia who saw me standing at the sort of corner of the tattoo parlor, basically shaking, kind of terrified. And she said, okay, everyone, Ema's not going to do the rehearsal. I'm going to do the rehearsal. And so Lydia got on top in her like North Face and her boots and her jeans on top of this sporting artist. I said, do you mind if I just do this? And he went, yeah, no worries. And just sort of cowgirl rode him, like screaming in front of the whole crew. And all the crew laughed so much and all the tension was broken. And then when I went in and did my thing, it was so relaxed and so chill because I'd seen her completely humiliate herself. So it was the most amazing like moment where she did that for me. And I actually it was, you know, it wasn't a bad experience, but I just felt at that point, I need something else. I need to be doing something else that will allow me some control over my career.
Basically. Yeah, of course. So just to jump in there.
Yeah.
That is, no, it's fine. But that is so wonderful and thoughtful.
Yeah.
Of that first AD do that, to break the ice.
Yeah.
And the tension was obviously gone for you. But,
yeah.
But even that, I hate the thought of you or anybody being feeling like they have to do something like that or they won't get the job, especially with news breaking all the time of people being forced into auditions. And, you know, there is never a reason where you need to be intimate with anybody or take your clothes off at an audition at all. I've heard stories of people having to kiss at an audition to show chemistry. Now, I've been intimate on screen and never, ever have I been asked to do anything like that. Mm-hmm. And nor should anybody. I think it's slightly terrifying that people get away with things like that. And I always say to younger actors, no.
Do not do it.
You have the right to say no and question things all the time.
Yeah, I know. And I think it has got better, so much better. At that time, it was really quite bad. And I remember even recently, like it wasn't recently, it was probably about 5-6 years ago, I did another sex scene and I had the producer, the writer and the director all in my trailer saying, no, we've got to do it like this, we want to do it like this. And I was saying, no, I'm not doing it like that. That's particular position or whatever. I want to do it like this. I remember having this big argument. And I just remember thinking as I was sitting there, I'm old enough now and experienced enough now to say, no, I'm not doing it like that. But if that had been back when I started, I would have just gone, okay. And then been horrified when it was on YouTube, you know, and or, you know, just taken out of context.
Or cut up and put somewhere else.
Exactly, which is what it does happen.
Yeah, it does happen.
And
also, you'd have, if that those three people were in your trailer.
Yeah.
All demanding one thing on you. It's like ganging up. That's like...
No, I know. And I remember, those guys, I really like them actually. And they're really great. It was just this odd situation. But in the end, we came to the conclusion that I said, look, let me shoot it my way first. Let me do my version. And then if you're still unhappy, maybe we'll do the other version. But let me try it first because I know what I'm doing with this. We did it. They laughed. That was the scene we shot. And so, you know, if anyone's listening who gets into that position, that's a good tactic to try. Because you're often like, you feel powerless and you have to find a way.
Exactly. You have to feel comfortable in it. And you know what? Nobody should be forced into doing something that they don't want to do. And also, your phone's there. Call your agent.
Call your agent, yeah.
Without a shadow of a doubt, don't feel, never, no one should ever feel pressured into doing stuff like that.
I know. And I think it happens to women a lot more, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I think it happens to young women a lot. And I think, you know, lots of actors I know haven't really done sex scenes, but most actresses I know have. And so it just often the parts just require it. And so,
you know, if the story is going to need to require it for a very strong and specific reason.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you watch a love scene or a sex scene, whatever it is, and you go, there's just no need. there is no need for that at all. It's what's it meant to spark off for the audience? I'm not at all titillated in any way. Does it move the story along? No. In fact, what it does is slows it down. So you want
sorry.
To... No. I was just going off on one thing about certain things like that, you know. But it is important, isn't it, you know, to talk about those
things. Yeah, no, totally. And the mad thing is, I was doing a job recently, The Curse.
Yeah.
Full of sex scenes.
All for the
sex
scenes.
I don't want to see Big Tom Davis naked.
I was talking to Alan, who plays my husband in it. And
who you're, I don't tend to talk about work, but I will talk about it later on. But just to jump in, you two together talk about chemistry. It's like you proper are like a married couple.
Oh yeah, we were bickering like a married couple straight away.
You were sparked off each other so brilliantly.
Oh, thank you. It was fantastic. No, that was the case. I think we knew from the audition, like we had great chemistry. But I was that first scene that we do together where we have to kiss, and I realised by the look in his eyes, he hasn't really had to kiss very many people. He just looked terrified. And I said, how many people have you kissed on screen? He's like, And basically, in his show, people just do nothing. The girl who plays his girlfriend and then his wife, it's sort of a joke that they never kiss, that he doesn't really want to kiss her. And so he's not had to do it. And I realised the difference between us is that basically, just because of our gender, I've done so much of that because I'm always playing someone's girlfriend or wife or whatever, and he's had to do like none. I was like, okay, so this is completely new for you, where this is like just a day at work. I just said, lie back and let me do the work.
I'll take control of this.
Yeah.
But did you, so it was sort of in your teens that you went, yeah, I need to take control of this. I can't wait for the phone to start calling.
Well,
ringing.
the big catalyst, really, which I never really say because I don't want to give him any credit, but I had my heart broken unbelievably badly when I was about 19.
Right.
And I couldn't sleep because I was, you know,
devastated,
wailing, couldn't eat, like just walking around sort of looking like a zombie, kind of heartbroken. And I didn't know what to do with all this new time I had because I couldn't sleep. And I, one day, just in the middle of the night, decided I'm just going to start writing something because I have to do something to stop thinking about him. And I wrote a whole script, and it was terrible, but it was the script. You know, I was like looking at it thinking like, oh, that's a whole thing that I've done. And that was the beginning, really. So I hate giving him credit for doing anything good in my life. I love the idea that something horrible can happen to you and you can turn it into something good for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the perfect end, isn't it?
Yeah.
Through heartbreak.
Yeah. Comes scripts.
But also, you know, certain writers always say, just carry on writing. Inevitably, it's not going to be great
the
first time, but get it done, get it finished.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I always say.
And then go back.
Anyone. Yeah.
And so did you... Were you sort of self-taught with your writing, or did you seek out to sort of gain more knowledge?
So I wrote a lot of rubbish stuff myself, and then I saw a competition that the BBC ran, which was basically advertised as, do you want to write your own skins? And I applied with a script that I'd written in the middle of the night, heartbroken.
As in Skins, like the Channel 4 show?
Yeah. It was actually a really misleading advert, because it was actually an advert to write for a spin-off of EastEnders, but they'd advertised it as, do you want to write Skins? Because they thought that they would kind of, they were sort of saying, it's like Skins.
So they were drawn like, in the young blood.
It's like the EastEnders version of Skins. But we ended up having a writer's room on that, which was about 13 young teenagers, not young teenagers, older teenagers. And we sat in a room, and the BBC ran it, and they sort of taught us how to write for a month. And then we each went off and wrote 10-minute episodes for BBC Three and online. And that's where I sort of started to learn how to do it properly. And then it kind of went from there.
And did you find it as enjoyable as when you were in, like, in front of a camera?
No.
I mean, no.
No way.
Because it's quite solitary.
Oh, I hate writing. I really do. I hate it. It's, the process is awful. And also, if you're writing and it feels awful, I think that's normal, because it's like running. Like it's an uncomfortable thing to do, but the feeling having done it is good, and that's why you do it, I think.
So it's the end goal.
It's the end goal.
Yeah.
I absolutely hate writing a script, but I love having written a script. So yeah, when I was writing, I was thinking, oh God, this is awful. Why am I doing this? But ultimately, quite rewarding.
Are you good at cracking on with it, even though you know it's going to be a slog and you don't like it? Or are you, because if you're in your house and you're writing, there's so many distractions.
Laundry.
I'm just going to
I'm just going to clean that. That mark on the cook has been annoying me. I think I'll just go and clean that off, or I'll go and do the washing, or...
Yeah, I always say to my mum, who's known my writing process for a long time, is that I've sort of learnt my process now, which is like I have to bore myself into it. Right. Like I have to have at least a week of boring myself until I'm like, oh, there's nothing else on my to-do list. I've got to do it. But I used to be terrible. I used to be terrible at cracking on. I used to leave it genuinely, you know, night before, kind of stay up all night. I remember one time I was writing an episode of Holby City and I stayed up for 3 days. I didn't go to sleep.
My God, that's like cramming for exams.
Which was all I'd ever known. So I just did it as like I was sort of, you know, preparing for an A-level, like rather than kind of any actual proper process. And I didn't go to university or anything, so I didn't ever write a dissertation. I just kind of ambled into this career and kind of tried to work out how to do it. And at the beginning, it was honestly just drink loads of Diet Coke, stay up for nights on end, and write these scripts that were slightly manic. And now I've cracked it. Now I'm like, you know what? You can just start a bit earlier and then you can sleep.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say sleep's important.
Yeah, but I was, you know, I was 21. I didn't really know how to live my life properly yet. So at that point, it seemed like a completely fine thing to just spend 3 days manically writing.
And also at 21, you can do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't even look any worse afterwards.
In some respects, probably look better.
Yeah.
Are you more structured now?
Yeah.
So, if you've got something to deliver, are you quite sort of... Because I know some writers that get up at like 6, so everything's very peaceful, even outside, and they know that they've got till 9 and they can do that, then they might have breaks. What are you like?
I think writing in the morning is better. I think I was a bit nocturnal for a while and it didn't work for me. I think if you get up and crack on, at least you get something done in the day. I don't have a real sort of kind of structure. It's just, there's the deadline. How long do I need before? How, you know, what's realistic without sending myself crazy? So it's not like a wake up at 6, but it's just like a kind of cancel everything I can cancel this few weeks. Let's crack on with it.
And you're quite disciplined. Like, it's 'cause I know some people that take themselves off. Some people have like a shed at the back of the garden and they don't have any internet.
Oh, God.
Just in case they can just, I'm just going to have a look here for 10 minutes. 10 minutes turns into an hour.
Yeah. And I've got the internet. I've got a really nice space for it. I after years of genuinely writing in bed or writing on the sofa or writing, you know, in a trailer or writing in a car, I realised it would be a better thing to have a nice desk. So I kind of created a space for it. And my writing is so much better because I actually want to sit down and do it there.
Yeah. Although some people do like writing in bed.
I know. I think, I still probably could go back to that eventually. Like, I just
fall asleep. It's just too comfy.
That's the thing, it's too comfy, exactly. And also, now I'm kind of written a whole show and stuff, you get to the point where the writing is so relentless that you have to separate the writing off from the rest of your life. And it was a bit like that in lockdown as well, when it's like, if you are constantly chewing on something and tapping away at your laptop, you have to put that into a physical space away from bed and your sofa, otherwise you will just only do that. And I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking about that and like reach for my laptop. And that, I felt like that was unhealthy. Not as unhealthy as a Diet Coke since staying up for 3 days, but still kind of not great.
No, not at all. But it's as unhealthy as not saying no to jobs and not giving yourself that time off.
Yeah.
And just constantly going, no, I have to work. Otherwise it's all going to stop. It's not going to all stop.
No.
It's going to carry on and you just fit back into it
100%.
When you need to. But, you know, it's easier said than done. It's,
and
it's, I suppose it's a bit age, with age and a bit more
experience.
Time, experience and knowledge.
Wisdom,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I won't go so far as to say wisdom. So, I mean, not for me anyway. So after within the EastEnders spin-off writing room, had you looked and sort of seeked out a writing agent at that point?
I had work that was going to be on TV because we had these like 10 minutes episodes. I asked at my acting agency. I said, I don't know where to start with this. How do I get a writing agent? And they luckily had a sort of young agent who was taking on a few clients, and she read my stuff and she took me on, and she was kind of starting out in the same way that I was, and it was a really great match. Just so lucky
within their literary department.
Right, brilliant. Yeah. It was so lucky that we found each other, I think. Well, it was lucky for me.
And you clicked.
We clicked so well. And that doesn't always happen, you know.
No, I was talking about this the other week. It's like, I think I might have been talking to John Sim about it. I know certain younger actors, forgive me, listeners, for revealing myself here, but younger agents who are kind of too scared to call their agents.
Oh, my God, like, yeah.
You work together. You're a team. It's like, you know, it's like any sort of relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a hard dynamic to get right, and you're so lucky if you get it right.
Yeah, but I think, as with anything, you never get it right the first time.
No, exactly, exactly. But I just landed with Jenny, who, that's her name, Jenny Miller, and she just was great, and she was really good at kind of motivating me and telling me, you know, guiding me, which was really helpful. And I've been with her ever since.
And was she, at first, was she guiding you to sort of, you know, get your writing wings, as in go and write an episode of this that's already established before you move on to original stuff? Or what?
A bit of both, really. Right. I wrote some spec scripts, so it was just me sitting down, and I wrote a script about a girl who found out she was a fairy, or like, you know, that kind of like wacky stuff that never got made. But then I did the BBC Writers Academy, which was, I think it's still running in some form, but they sort of, John York kind of trains you for 3 months, and you get paid like it's a job to go and be trained, which was amazing.
Yeah, that is great.
And then you got given an episode of Casualty, an episode of EastEnders, an episode of Doctors, an episode of Holby. So it was like this amazing kind of, it was my university really, that these kind of BBC things that they run and have run. So I kind of did a bit of both of kind of exploring what I would like to write, writing all these, churning out these kind of scripts that were getting better and better, but also learning how to write within the machine of those shows. Which was really helpful, as much for the work ethic as it is for the skill of writing, because the nature of sitting down and having to write something for a deadline, I mean, as you say, it's something that you need to kind of practice, because we don't all have that, like, sort of discipline straight away.
And you don't want to keep people waiting.
No, you don't mean it. It's so stressful.
You know. It takes a couple of weeks to get a bad reputation and about two years to sort of get back to it, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you find balancing, or getting back to getting some sort of balance of being a working writer and also being a working actor?
It was mad for a bit. I remember I was filming an episode of an E4 show called Beaver Falls, which was so fun. We went to film it in South Africa, and it was about a summer camp. And I was filming that in the day, and then I'd go home and I would be writing an episode of EastEnders at night. And I was just trying to kind of keep them both going. And I would often mistakenly sort of pretend to both productions that I wasn't doing the other one.
See, basically, just lie, basically. To get everything back on balance, just lie.
Yeah, and it was unbelievably stressful. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone, but I learned the hard way. And they both got done, you know, all the work happened. But I was at that stage where I kind of couldn't just be honest and say, I need a little bit more time for this. I would just go home and panic and start writing.
Are you better at that now, with regards to writing, saying, if it's going to be good, you just need to give me a little bit more time?
Yeah, I'm getting better at that, I think. But then, you know, people listen to you more as you get further up the ladder. And, you know, working on my show that I've written the whole of, I can say, realistically, it's not going to be in now, it's going to be in by then. I think people, you know, they don't shout at you as much as you do when you're like a junior writer on EastEnders and they need to film in like 3 days. So it changes like that. You get more respect.
Do you write with anybody else?
I've never written with anyone else.
Because I can imagine that being really hard.
I've never done it for a reason. I think the reason I write is because I think creatively I'm incredibly controlling.
I don't think, I'm laughing, but I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think if people were honest, I think most people are.
Yeah.
Especially when they care about what they do or whether they're going to be seen on screen or on stage.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. If you care about what you do and is your name on it or your face on
exactly.
it. I think a lot of creative people are incredible, especially successful creative people. They're very controlling. And I actually realised that the more I just kind of accept that about myself in my work, the less I'm like that in real life. Like in my sort of relationships, I just kind of way more relaxed if I know that the thing I'm doing, I can have complete control over and I'm doing what I want. I'm expressing myself fully. So I kind of just owning the controlling nature now. And it's like, it's actually a good thing. And you kind of, I realize that you want to be led when you're creating a show by somebody who knows exactly what they want. And they can tell you clearly, this is what we're doing. In fact, that actually makes everyone else relax because you don't have to kind of work out what the project is really about, or you know. So I kind of just embraced my perfectionist controlling nature.
as one ever overtook the other, as in, well, I think I'm just going to focus on writing and leave, and vice versa. Or have you ever thought, do you know what? I don't think I'm going to do acting anymore. I'm just going to focus on the writing.
I have never got to that point. I think I would be really unhappy if I was just writing because of the unhappiness of the process.
And also probably, obviously, from what I'm getting, the love of both.
Yeah. And I love the process of acting much more than I love the process of writing. Just the rewards of writing are great because you have these things that you've created. But the actual process is really, really grueling. And the process of acting is, I find, joyful and just fun and challenging in a much more exciting way. Whereas writing is challenging in a really hard way.
are you good at switching your writer's head off when you're acting?
Yeah.
Because
Because
sometimes if you get a script, you're not tempted to go, don't really agree with this. I think if we change this to this.
I find, because of the writing and the kind of being in control over that, I find it really relaxing to give up control when I'm acting. I love the process of being like, this is their show, they've written it, they're producing it, I don't have to do anything. I just have to turn up as this character.
And serve the script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, weirdly, you work with other actors who are not like that, and I think they want to have more influence on the script because they maybe don't have the outlet of something else, so they can get intense about that. And I understand that. But I often kind of, I just let it go. I'm just going to give you what this character needs.
I think it's really important because there's so many people on a set who are doing their job. You don't think for one second to go over and discuss why you think that light should be shifted to the left. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, unless there's a challenge or you think you need to talk about the script, probably just leave it well alone and focus on what you're doing.
Yeah, and I worked with an actor the other day. She was so good. And she said, there was another actor who was kind of complaining about not having enough lines. And another...
It's tricky.
I know, and another actress said, look, we're here to do these lines, the number that you've been given, but also to make these lines sound as natural and as sound what they should be.
And also this is the first time these words have come out of anybody's mouth.
Yeah.
That's the job.
Yeah, and do the job of making it sound right. If you don't like the line, just work out however you have to do to make it sound right. And sometimes, obviously, you have to go to the writer and say, I'm not sure, or the director. And actually, when we did Karen Perry, which is the show I wrote, one of the actors said to me, you're too open to the actors because everyone's having their penny's worth with you. And I just felt like, I really want to hear those ideas, actually, from the other side. I really want to hear what they're saying. And some really great lines came of it. But it was done the right way in that they sort of came in advance and said, what do you think about this? Can I change this? And then I would put it in the script. And then it would be there for everyone to see rather than like that kind of shifting sounds moment when it can kind of, people are kind of trying to change stuff on set, which I think can be more difficult.
But there is a way of approaching that. And I'm saying, we should always just serve the script. And I'm speaking from when I was younger and I was probably definitely gobby.
Yeah.
And went, I can't say that. That doesn't mean anything. We've got to change this. It's like, Craig, oh God. I mean, I don't really sort of deal in regrets, but it's like, was that what we were talking about time and knowledge and a bit of experience?
Yeah.
And you can look back and you go, oh God. Why did I behave like that?
Well, I think it's interesting because it totally depends on the part as well, because I think, you know, when I wrote on soaps, those actors know those characters so well. They've been playing them for like decades.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, these writers, I was one of them, come in, write an episode, you might not necessarily get the character's voice right. And I think they do know what that voice, and, you know, not just soaps, there are loads of shows where someone's played a character for a really long time and you as a writer might not crack it. So I do think that, you know, that there are situations where the actor does know better. And then there are some where actually, you know, this person has written like 12 drafts of the script. This is the line you have to say.
Yeah, it's interesting. I very rarely sort of deflect back onto me, but as soon as we're talking about scripts and character, I was doing the second series of a show that shan't be named years ago. And I remember getting the first three scripts for the second series, and I was flicking through and I was reading, I was going, yeah, that says my character, speaks this, but it doesn't sound anything like him.
Yeah.
He wouldn't say this. And lo and behold, I got called into the production office prior to flying away to start the second series, and they went, so look, we don't know what to do with this character. And I went, well, no disrespect, but I can tell.
And they went, we're
going to kill him off. I went, that's absolutely fine. Don't worry. Straight onto the agent. Do I get paid for the full series? Absolutely. Kill away. Kill away, lads. But it's fine. But I love that honesty. That was so respectful for them to go, we don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So if in doubt,
kill them.
Stick a bomb under it. How are you at auditions? Not that we've been having face-to-face auditions for the past few years, but
I don't know, because I don't know how anyone else is at auditions. You know, you only ever experience your own.
Of course.
But when we were casting Karen Peary, I was in on the casting process, so I was watching everyone else's audition tapes.
Ah, so you're watching from the other side of the tape.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
Tell me about that. How interesting was that? Was that the first time you were doing that?
Yeah, the first time ever. I loved the casting process. I loved it. I found it so interesting, and I found it really, really challenging as well. It's a really tough job. But I found it really affirming about acting, because there was just such an array of performances, and some of them were really amazing and some of them were a little rougher. And I came out of it feeling like just a lot of love for so many actors that they're all doing this. And that made me feel really good.
Did you feel empathy with those people because you'd possibly been in that situation yourself over the years?
Yeah, or just worried that I had. Worried that I'd turned an audition that was no good. I mean, how do you know?
Constant worry.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes it's really hard now, because if you get sent pages for something that's so secretive.
Yeah. You have no idea. You've got like four lines in a scene where you've no idea what's going on. And I hate the auditions where you get where it's like, she throws the table across the room. And of course you're not going to do that.
I can't do that.
No! I remember my cousin auditioned for, I think it was X-Men, like years and years and years ago. And he said he had to do a scene which only had like two lines. And there was a bit of it in the middle where it was like, he grows wings from his back. And he was just like, what do I do in that bit?
Give us a minute for that. Let me think, how can we do this?
Yeah. Just how ridiculous it is to have to be like... it gave me a lot of love for...
Did you feel that, because you were invited into the casting process, obviously, because you're the writer, did you feel you had a voice or your voice was being heard?
Yeah, totally.
Right.
Well, I'm very controlling. So they knew.
Good.
No, yeah, me and the casting director would just get on the phone and discuss it all. And he just had so much, he just was brilliant and had so much love for actors. He was an actor previously as well. And I just loved that sometimes someone would send a tape that wasn't quite right, but we'd be going, okay, well, how can we see the bit that we want to see?
Yeah, yeah,
which I love to know, because you want to know that people are out there doing that. Because as an actor, it's so, you're as powerless. And actually, I think there are lots of people on the other side of the camera who are like really encouraging and wanting to find the right part of that person, not just the right person, you know. And it was, I really felt comforted.
But that's the thing. I was doing a talk the other year to, sadly, a group of actors who were graduating, you know, on Zoom.
And it's like, my God.
But I was saying about the audition process, because they said they hadn't done a lot of audition technique. And I said, well, it's really difficult because... I said, the one thing that you need to know and you need to hold in your heart, they want to cast. They need to cast
part.
They want to cast it.
Yeah.
They're willing. They're willing you to be good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's so weird that like you when you're young particularly, you don't think that.
You think that they're ready to kick you out. Yeah.
When actually they really need the right person for this, and they're really looking. And that's how I felt. I was like, going to sleep at night, a lot of staring at the scene, like, where is this character? Where, you know, when are we going to get a tape? And we always found them. It was just...
Did anybody come in and completely blow you away, but you hadn't thought that the character was like that at all? They kind of interpreted it completely differently and changed your mind by it.
There was a process with one of the characters... which after I'd seen a particular audition tape, he didn't actually end up doing it, he took another job, but he did such a reading of it that changed the character in the script from then on, because it was so brilliant.
Again, I think that's really important, is to trust your gut with how you feel it should be.
Yeah, totally. This character was really laddie in the way that I'd written it, and quite a bit sexist, and he came in and played the exact same lines, word for word, so he didn't change anything, but he played it a bit naive and kind of like he'd learned how to be a lad, but he wasn't a bit half-hearted with it.
Right.
And that's kind of the way the character ended up going. Quite just a sweeter side to that character, and that character's now so lovable on screen. And another actor played it, but also I wonder if, because the actor who actually played it came in a bit later, if the way that I'd started to write it then kind of opened it up to another actor. And where we ended up was brilliant. But exactly as you say, that first actor just kind of giving it a spin that wasn't necessarily in the script completely changed the entire kind of process for me, which I loved, because it's like ideas, isn't it? It's like, oh my God, amazing idea, great.
Exactly. I think you've got to trust your gut and go in with what you feel.
Yeah.
And if it's... not someone's taste, then that's okay. But at least you can walk out of there with your head held high and go, no, I did my interpretation. And I think it's that good. Not in an arrogant or a cocky way.
No, yeah.
But in, you know, just to have a bit of self-belief.
But also so many times we'd see someone and they'd do a great performance that wasn't right for the character, and they would get cast in something else in the show because we had another character who they would be better suited for, but they were just so good and gave such a great take on the character that we'd be like, we've got to cast them as something. Like, what else do we have that we can do? So I always think whenever I get an audition, I think I'm not quite right for this, but I'm just going to go in and give my version.
And do the best that
possibly. Because they might see me for something. They might think, oh, she's not this, but she's something else.
But also, it's that thing about, even if you don't get a job, maybe a month later, you get a call from that same casting director.
Yeah.
And it's because you did a great job, even though you didn't get it.
Yeah.
You know, it's something else has come back around.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How are you with rejection?
How am I with rejection? It's a sliding scale, isn't it? It's like, it's all relative to how everyone else is with rejection. I think
Are you good at sort of brushing yourself down and picking yourself up?
Yeah, I think you have to be, don't you?
But again, I think does that come with
time? With time. I think so, there were some big rejections early on that still hurt, you know? I still can't watch those shows.
Oh, God, no.
There's like whole swathes of shows.
Jesus, man. I didn't have a TV for like 11 years, right? And I went, I don't need to watch that. And if the phone goes, still to this day. And it goes, yeah, they've gone with blah, blah, blah. I went, okay, okay. And before they get to blah, 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 now I've gone, they've gone with, you don't, I don't know,
no. Don't tell me.
Don't tell me. Don't need to know. I won't be watching it. Yeah. And it, for my peace of mind, and I need to heal and sort of move on.
Yeah.
But yeah, those big rejections are hard, aren't
they? Yeah, but you know, I had some rejections the other way around. So we went out to people with the scripts to some actors, and they read it and said no. And I took that rejection.
Course.
I took that even harder. I remember I cried my eyes out. One actor saying no, and I remember thinking, oh my god, this is worse because I've spent a really long time writing these scripts.
It's even in a way, because you know when you get rejected, that to go, they always go, look, it's not personal. Yes, it is personal.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you put your time in blood, sweat, and tears, and these are your words.
No, I know.
Fuck, that is personal,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I also realised that I did the recall for The Curse, and I remember Alan, I was sitting opposite him, and I did this sort of seduction scene with him, and I remember he looked at me and went, that was sick. And I remember thinking, Ema, remember this when you go home, because you're going to go home and beat yourself up that you weren't good enough.
Yeah, because you're going to think about all the bad things.
All of the bad things, yeah. And all the bits where you
were
nervous.
Why did I ...
Yeah, and I remember thinking, remember this. He's saying this, that's sick. I went home and I cried because I thought I'd messed it up. And I was thinking, what is wrong with me?
Look, nothing wrong with you, because there is a list and a line as long as you can imagine. Because you know, but it's so hard to put that into perspective when you're feeling that. You're going, everybody's feeling that. Yeah. But no, I feel like I've really fucked it up.
Yeah, I know. And I was, for the whole weekend, I was really gutted because I thought I could have been better. And this part is, I'm right for this. And then the next week I found out I'd got it. And I was like, what? My brain is eating itself. It just wants to believe I've messed it up for some reason, yeah. And I'm looking for evidence everywhere.
Oh yeah, and you're finding it, and sometimes it doesn't. You know, like those memories from the past when you were younger. Then you speak to somebody else, and they go, yeah, sorry, that didn't happen like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in your mind, you go, oh no, it definitely did.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's the same when you're thinking about all the bad things.
I know.
And then whenever I have those feelings, because I have the exact same feelings as well.
Yeah.
Like I'm sort of texting my agent, or I'll email going, yeah, I mean, can you just double check and make sure that, because I think I said something, I wouldn't want them to take it the wrong way. I'm constantly worrying.
I just before I'd gone into the audition, they were all like raucously laughing, I think, at another girl in the room. And I remember thinking,
oh God, that's so hard to walk into the lion's den, like going, funny, what's he?
No, but you know, on set, Alan would be saying, no, you smashed it. What? Why? Like, why did you feel you didn't? I have no idea. I now have to say to myself, Ema, remember this. You felt awful and you got it, so don't do that again.
Oh, you'll do it again.
Yeah, exactly.
You definitely do it again.
Yeah, I know.
And that's not a criticism, because we all do it again.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's just the way it is. But yet again, we still carry on doing it to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We touched on it there. I want to kind of... And as I say, I don't talk about jobs, but because you're on, and because Big Tom's a friend, and because it's such a cracking series that I want people to hear. Whenever anybody emails me and goes, oh, can we come on and talk about such and such? Well, no, because it's not that type of podcast.
Yeah, yeah,
and there's plenty of other podcasts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Plenty of other shows that you can go on and sell your wares. This isn't that.
Mm-hmm.
But how was it for you when you got that script from these lads, because they're all quite raucous and they're all very different comedy styles that's come together. So you've got the people just do nothing boys, and then you've got Tom and James, who are very different in style, but it just gels and it all works together.
Yeah. Well, I think they work really similarly. So they do loads of improv.
Yeah, I mean,
which was, you know, I've done enough improv, so like in my life, that I was ready for it. But it was absolutely terrifying with those boys, because they've just been working together for so long and they're all mates.
Yeah,
and also, you know, it's a group of guys, and I was the only girl in there, and it was like we were a gang, and I kind of had to go from 0 to 100 in terms of confidence really quickly, because I just knew if I didn't try and chip in early, I was going to struggle. I had to like get in there and kind of just say what I thought the character would say.
But
you know?
Also, she's such a strong character.
Oh, thank
and
you.
She's cleverer than all than of them everyone. Put together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and in a way, she's kind of the mastermind
yeah, yeah,
of everything.
Totally. But that was a challenge in itself because a lot of their comedy comes from being the idiots. Like, they are all stupid.
I mean, the idiot is always funny.
Exactly. And she's not an idiot. No. So trying to find the comedy with her was really difficult because she's always the smartest one in the room. And so when everyone else is sort of playing the fool, how do you get her... How do you give her, you know, how do you find the comedy with her? It just turns out she has to just be sort of quick and smart and kind of shut up, you know, like that's her attitude.
Yeah, and she's quite dry as
yeah,
well, especially
yeah.
when she's dating
yeah,
with
exactly
the idiots.
It's kind of cutting through that
yeah.
that's the kind of attitude of her. But they didn't know who was going to play it, obviously, so they didn't write it for anyone in the way that they wrote those characters for themselves.
Yeah.
So there was a kind of element of, like, trying to find her in the rehearsal process and then on set as well.
Did you have a lot of rehearsal time?
Yeah, we did a couple of days sitting with the boys.
Which, again, you know, even if you only had a couple of days, that's still unusual.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally.
For telly.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, they were kind of working on the scripts as we went, so they were kind of polishing it up and making sure it all worked. But it was also a really good time for me to get to know those boys because it's basically like being the new kid at school. You're walking into like a group of mates. It's not
and
just...
They're already established.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But they were so brilliant. They were so nice to me and so funny. And like we said before, me and Alan, I think, just really clicked immediately.
I mean, it, for anybody that's seen it, do watch it. But as I said before, you can really tell the chemistry between you two. You are like an old married couple who run a calf.
Yeah, and I remember like a couple of the boys weren't in the scenes that we were in. And so we had like a week in the calf with just me and him where we really, really got on and gelled. And by the time all the other boys came back, we were like really arguing with each other in between days. And everyone was like, oh my God, what's happened? It's like they've actually got married. Yeah.
But an enjoyable process, an absolute dream of a job.
Dream of a job. I mean, I just laughed for 8 weeks.
But isn't it interesting when you think, you do a dream of a job and then you think, oh, nothing like that is ever going to come round again. But it does.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
a different guise.
Yeah,
completely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I kind of took comfort from it because I'd just finished filming something that I'd written, which had been magical but unbelievably hard from a creative perspective because I was responsible for everything. And out of nowhere, this job came along. And, you know, I remember sitting on set and being like, I had no idea this was going to happen this year. This is the most amazing experience I'm having, and we're making such a great show. And who knows what's around the corner? No one really knows with our jobs, and that's the magic of it. You don't know if you can go to your best friend's wedding next year because you don't know it that far in advance. But you have no idea what job might happen as well, and that's kind of I think why we all do it because anything could change at any moment, and suddenly you're sitting there in a calf improvising for hours about the stupidest stuff, thinking I get paid for this.
And that's why we keep doing it, because
yeah.
it's so fucking exciting.
Yeah, exactly.
Lee McKenney, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
And another episode is done. And what an absolute cracker of an episode that was. I hope you enjoyed it. I see, I try not to let you down. And if you support us over on patreon.com/thetwoshotpodcast, you would have found out who our guest was this week, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to release that to the Patreon backers days earlier than everybody else. So you special supportive lovely people get to find out who the guest is. Also over on Patreon, there is more audio of today's episode with a special Q&A episode with Ian McKenney that didn't go out on the live feed. That's just for the people who support us. And if you want to support us, you can over on patreon.com/twoshotpodcast. And that's it for this week. I've got to go because we've got more busy half-term plans to deal with. As you can hear in the background. Who is next week's guest? Yeah, I don't know yet. I don't know. I haven't worked it out. But I will do. Bear with me. Okay? Great. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Half Term Podcast. Take care. I'll see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.